some stuff as we go. So this is chapter three, more about alchemism. And on top of the page, what I wrote was obsession. Right on top of the page, if you've got some markers for this chapter, I wrote obsession. This is what's going to describe the mental state that precedes the first drink. Because it's described within this book. It says obsession, insanity, strange mental blank spot. Peculiar mental twist. You've all got that. Except Phil. And then curious mental phenomenon. Because, like I said, a phenomenon is an unexplained event. Now, these terms I've just written out, it's obsession, insanity, strange mental blank spot, peculiar mental twist, insanity, curious mental phenomenon, all describe the obsession and the insanity of the sentence in our mind, right? They're just different terms that they use. So we're going to start now. Top of page 30 says, most of us have been unwilling to admit that we were real alcoholics, right? Now, people ask me, what's this real alcoholic? So one that's lost the power of choice. Many people come to AA. We read in There's a Solution 2, 3 weeks ago, and it spoke about the moderate drinker and a hard drinker. And they're given sufficient reason. They can stop or moderate. They can go weeks and months and years without picking a drink up, but that time and place will come. But the real alcoholic is the one that when we start, we cannot stop. And on page 44, we're going to read that next week. It's going to give us two questions to ask the newcomer, to qualify the newcomer, that people don't like that. When I say I'm going to qualify a newcomer, let me tell you, it sends a lot of people off. Because they say, what gives you the right to qualify the newcomer? They should know if they're alcoholic. Well, I didn't know what alcoholism was till I come to AA, until it was explained to me through going through the book and understanding that. We're real alcoholics. Nobody likes to believe, likes to think, and underline this, is bodily and mentally. They're the two symptoms of alcoholism. Doesn't say the spiritual malady. Doesn't say fear, trauma, depression, anxiety. Doesn't say none of that stuff. Bodily and mentally, mind and body, right? Different from his fellows. Therefore, it's not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized and underlined this by countless vain attempts to prove that we could drink like other people. Because that's what we would do. We're going to count our drinking. Normal people don't count what they drink. They go and buy it and they drink what they want to drink and they stop when they want to stop. But us that are alcoholics, we cannot control that. So we count and we try and prove that we're not alcoholic. And I highlighted these next, I highlighted, to be fair, from the idea all the way down to worse, never better, two paragraphs. I highlighted the whole lot because it's really quite an important part of this chapter. It says the idea, an idea is the obsession, right? There's the idea that somehow, someday, he would control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. That's us. The great obsession, this time it's going to be different. This time I'm going to control it. This time I won't get drunk, I promise. I swear, right? It then says the persistence of this illusion, an illusion is a lie that I tell myself, is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death because they cannot stop and they cannot stay stopped. They pursue that illusion that this time it's going to be different, the great obsession, right? And these are important to underline this. We learned, which means we're going to be taught. We had to fully concede to our innermost self that we're alcoholics. What does that mean? Fully concede to our innermost self. That means I need to know I'm an alcoholic or not. And when I get to step one, I'm going to look at what the damage I caused, the problems, the consequences. I can't see that because the insanity blocks out all the problems. So now I'm sober in a sober mind, and someone's telling me, Keith, you've got this obsession, it's going to justify the next drink. I need to look at the problems and the consequences and the hurt and the damage and the health and the wealth and the finances and the jobs and the relationships that get affected by my drinking. Because I keep pursuing the same illusion that this time it's going to be different. So we have to fully concede, fully admit to our innermost selves that we're alcoholics. I cannot drink safely in any form whatsoever. This is the first step in recovery. The delusion, we had illusion, now we've got a delusion, which is another lie, that we like other people, or presently maybe, and underline this, has to be smashed. Normal people don't do what I do. We read in one of the chapters, we see others drinking with impunity. What that means is they don't get any problems. We drink with punity, which means we get punished. When I drink to oblivion, I get punished because that missus is going to nag me and I'm going to lose my job and the wife. I get punished. I can't drink with impunity, right? We alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking, underlined it. That means we're powerless. We've lost the control of our drinking. We know that no real alcoholic ever recovers control. People say, yeah, I've got a choice nowadays. I don't know what you've got. You've got the realization that if you ever pick a drink up, you're going to get drunk. I don't have a choice to drink or not. Because if I choose to drink, the consequences are I'm going to black out. So I don't choose to drink. I just see the truth in my drinking. I see the consequences of my drinking. I've lost the power of choice. Right? All of us felt at times that we were regaining control. For such intervals, usually brief, will inevitably be followed by still less control, which led in time to pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. It means I was beat. I was done. I fouled, right? We are convinced to a man that alcoholics of our type, the real alcoholic, are in the grip of a progressing illness over a considerable period. We get, and underline this, worse, never better. You never get no better. It's going to give us examples now. So if we're like men that have lost their legs. What that means is now you've got the allergy, you can never drink safely at all. It's not like a cold and you can take some tablets and wash it off and then you can go and do other stuff again. But like men have lost their legs. Once they haven't formed that habit, that allergy, we won't break it. We can never drink safely in any form, right? They never grow new ones. Neither does there appear to be any kind of treatment which will make alcoholics of our type, underline this, like other men, the ones that drink normally and safely. We have tried every imaginable remedy. In some instances, there has been brief recovery, followed always by a still worse relapse. I've never had a relapse that's been all right. You? My relapses have always got worse. The consequences are worse. I've never had a relapse where that weren't too bad. Physicians who are familiar with alcoholism agree there's no such thing as making a normal drinker out of the alcoholic. Science may one day accomplish this, but it hasn't done so just yet. Despite all we can say, many who are real alcoholics are not going to believe they're in that class. And I underline these next three lines. By every form of self-deception, we had illusion and we had delusion, and now we've got self-deception. And experimentation, they would try to prove themselves the exception to the rule and therefore non-alcoholic. I'm going to control and enjoy it, right? Illusion, delusion, self-deception, the lies I tell myself. Obsession, right? If anyone is showing the ability to control his drinking and can do the right about face and drink like a gentleman, our hats are off to him. Heaven knows we have tried hard enough, long enough to drink like other people, which is the truth. Here are some of the methods we have tried. Drinking beer only, limiting the number of drinks, never drinking alone, never drinking in the morning, drinking only at home, never having it in the house. Never drinking during business hours, drinking only at parties, switching from scotch to brandy, drinking only natural wines, agreeing to resign if ever drunk on the job, taking a trip or not taking a trip, swearing off forever with and without a solemn oath, taking more physical exercise, reading inspirational books, going to health farms and sanitariums, accepting voluntary commitments to asylums. We could increase the list ad infinitum. We could do, because we've tried every remedy. I highlighted the next four lines. It's going to give you an instruction, right? We do not like to pronounce any individual's alcoholic, but you can quickly diagnose yourself. Step over to the nearest bar room, try some controlled drinking. Try to drink and to stop abruptly. Try it more than once. It will not take you long to decide, underline this, if you're honest with yourself about it, it may be worth a bad case of the jitters to get a full knowledge of your condition. If you're unsure, go to the nearest bar, go and try some controlled drinking. Because we told you what the problem is. If you're unsure, we're going to read this in Jim's story shortly about what Jim did, right? Though there's no way of proving it, we believe in our early drinking careers that most of us could have stopped drinking. But the difficulty is that few alcoholics have had enough desire to stop while there's still yet time. We've heard of a few instances where people who have showed definite signs of alcoholism were able to stop for a long period because of an overpowering desire to do so. Here's a story. Important story, right? A man of 30 was doing a great deal of spree drinking, which is blackout drinking. He was very nervous in the morning after these bouts of quieting himself with more liquor because of the shake, right? He was ambitious to succeed in business, but saw he could get nowhere if he drank at all. Once he started, he had no control whatever because he's got the allergic reaction, right? He made up his mind until he'd been successful in business, he had retired, he would not touch another drop. An exceptional man. He remained bone dry for 25 years. You see, it says bone dry. No program, no change, no God, right? For 25 years and retired at the age of 55 after a successful and a happy business career. I highlight the next four lines. So then he fell victim to the belief, which practically every alcoholic has, that his long period of sobriety and self-discipline had, and underline this, qualified him to drink as other men. Many do that, right? Out came his carpet slippers and a bottle. In 2 months, he's in the hospital, puzzled and humiliated. He tried to regulate his drinking for a while, making several trips to the hospital in the meantime. Then, gathering all of his forces, he attempted to stop altogether and found he could not. Every means of solving his problem, which money could buy, was at his disposal. Every attempt failed. Though a robust man at retirement, he went to pieces quickly, and underline this, he was dead within 4 years. If you don't get step one, if you don't smash home your own alcoholic, this will be us. And I say this in many meetings I attend, to drink is to die for the real alcoholic. We cannot control and enjoy it. We've had these examples already. This case contains a powerful lesson. Most of us have believed that we've remained sober for a long stretch. We could thereafter drink normally. But here's a man at 55 years found he was just as he was where he left off at 30. We have seen the truth demonstrated again and again, underlined it. Because we repeat this over and over again and again. We need to smash home we're an alcoholic. We cannot drink safely. We have lost the power of choice in drink. The allergy is for life. I say I'm recovered because I found the power that I lacked. It's the power that's going to solve the problem. The allergy is untreatable. You cannot touch it. We're like men that have lost their legs and never grown new ones. Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. Commencing to drink after a period of sobriety, we're in short time as bad as ever. If we are planning to stop drinking, there must be, and underline this, no reservation of any kind, nor any lurking notion that someday we will be immune to alcohol. Because you've got a condition that's untreatable. We're banging on about the allergy at the moment. Young people may be encouraged by this man's experience to think that they can stop, as he did, on their own willpower. We doubt if many of them can do it, because they none of them really want to stop. And hardly one of them, because of this, and underlined and highlighted this, a peculiar mental twist. The mind, right? The obsession, the insanity, the mental blank spot, the peculiar mental twist. That has already acquired. We'll find that he can win out. Several of our crowd, men of 30 or less, have been drinking over a few years. But they found themselves as helpless as those who've been drinking 20 years. To be gravely effective, one does not necessarily have to drink for a long time, nor take the quantities. I've done 5 years. And in 5 years, I've become a chronic, broken alcoholic. Let me tell you. And there was no turning back. And in 5 years, some of us have. This is particularly true of women. It's you lot, right? Potential female alcoholics often turn into the real thing and have gone beyond recall in a few years. That rings a bell, Phil, doesn't it? Certain drinkers would greatly be insulted if called alcoholics. Are astonished at their inability to stop. We are familiar with the symptoms they see in large numbers of potential alcoholics among young people everywhere. Top of 34, big page. But try and get them to see. As we look back, we feel we have gone on drinking many years beyond the point which we could quit on our own willpower. If anyone questions whether he is engaged into this dangerous area, let him try leaving liquor alone for 1 year. If he's a real alcoholic, very far advanced, has very scant chance of success. In the early days of our drinking, we occasionally remain sober for a year or more, becoming serious drinkers again later. Though you may be able to stop for a considerable period, you may yet be a potential alcoholic, underlined it. You may be a potential alcoholic. We think few to whom this book would appeal can stay dry anything like a year. Some will be drunk the day after making their resolutions, most of them within a few weeks. Now, I highlighted this next paragraph for those who are able to stop drinking down to necessity or wish. Huge part of this chapter, one of the most important parts of the book. For those unable to drink moderately, the real question is how to stop altogether. All right, we have a day at a time, a 24-hour plan, but if you're going to stop, there's going to be no lurking notion you have to quit forever, right? Altogether. We are assuming, of course, that the reader desires to stop. Whether such a person can quit on a non-spiritual basis depends upon the extent to which he has already lost the power to choose whether he will drink or not. Right? Many of us have plenty of character, and this is the important part. There was a tremendous urge to cease forever, yet we found it impossible. This is the baffling feature of alcoholism, as we know it, this utter inability to leave it alone, no matter how great the necessity or the wish. The baffling feature, because your mind is going to justify it. The obsession will say, this time it will be different. The insanity blocks out the consequences and the damage and the people and the places and the finances. And this time it's going to be different. No matter how great the necessity or the wish, we cannot stop on our own power. How then shall we help our readers to determine to their own satisfaction whether they're one of us with a question mark? How am I going to explain that? We've told you, go to the bar room and try some controlled drinking. We're going to give you some examples of some stories. The experiment of quitting for a period of time will be helpful, but we think we can render an even greater service to the alcoholic sufferers and perhaps to the medical fraternity. And I highlight this next paragraph from how shall we describe down to thinking, right? So shall we describe some of the mental states that precede a relapse into drinking? But obviously, this is the crux of the problem. Our thinking is the crux of the problem. The justification, the peculiar mental twist, the mental blank spot, the obsession, illusion, delusion. What sort of thinking dominates an alcoholic who repeats time after time the desperate experiment of the first drink with a question mark? The obsession, right? Friends who have reasoned with him after spree, which has brought him to the point of divorce or bankruptcy, are mystified when he walks directly into the saloon. Why does he? Because the insanity has blocked it out. The obsession takes over. Or what is he thinking? We just want that sense of ease and comfort by taking a few drinks, right? Next, that paragraph, I wrote malady. It's a mental malady. Malady means sickness. Even when you get to spiritual malady, malady in this book means sickness. We have a mental sickness, and it's obsession, illusion, delusion, peculiar mental twist. It's all part of the same group. Our first example is a friend we should call Jim. This is a guy called Jim Scott. Jim Scott was a sober member of AA, and he was edited for setting up the first black meetings in America, right? Jim Scott. This man has a charming wife and family, inherited a lucrative automobile agency, He had a commendable war record. He's a good salesman. Everybody likes him. He's an intelligent man, normal so far, as we can see, except for an underline is a nervous disposition. He did no drinking until he was 35. And in a few years, he became so violent when intoxicated that he had to be committed. On leaving the asylum, he came into contact with us. I underline the next two lines. I highlight the next two lines. He said, we told him what we knew of alcoholism. We told him of the mind and body. We told him of the obsession and the allergy. He then said, the answer we found, he made a beginning. When we make a beginning in AA, we stop drinking. That's the beginning. That's the start of the work when we put the drink down. His family was reassembled, and he began to work as a salesman for the business he had lost through drinking. So now he's got a job at his own business that he'd lost and sold. All went well for time, and underline this, but he failed to enlarge his spiritual life. So Jim knew what the problem was in step one. He knew there was a solution in step two. He never took the decision in step three. He never took that course of action through four, through nine to enlarge his spiritual life. He says, to his consternation or confusion, he found himself drunk half a dozen times in rapid succession. I highlighted it. Why? Because he didn't take the solution. He didn't take that course of action. So he kept getting drunk. On each of these occasions, we worked with him, reviewing carefully what had happened. He agreed he was a real alcoholic and in a serious condition. We knew he faced another trip to the asylum if he kept on. Moreover, he would lose his family, for whom he had deep affection. We told him, it's going to kill you, Jim. You're going to lose the wife and the kids and the business, Jim. He never treated the condition. You're dry drunk. Top of 36. Yeah, he got drunk again. We asked him to tell us exactly how it happened, and this is his story. Jim said, I came to work on Tuesday morning. Where was he on bloody Monday? He's hungover. He can't go over. Who here has not been part of the Monday Club, not turned up on Monday because we're too drunk? The boss is a bit pissed off because the boss had a job for him and he ain't turned up. No phone call. I came to work on Tuesday morning. I remember I felt irritated, hungover, and pissed off because he sold the business to another guy. I'd like to be a salesman for a concern that I once owned. I had a few words with the boss. The boss is saying, Jim, where were you yesterday? Well, I had some bad chicken. I didn't feel great, and wife had a cold, and I had to look after all the old alibis and stories and excuses, right? But nothing serious. Then I decided to drive to the country to see one of my prospects for a car. On the way, I felt hungry, so I stopped at a roadside place where they have a bar. And underlined this, I had no intention of drinking. Jim's hungover. The last thing he wants is a drink at 8 o'clock in the morning because he's hungover. I had no intention of drinking. Sanity, right? Plain sanity. I just thought I'd get a sandwich. I also had a notion that I might find a customer for a car at this place, which was familiar, for I've been going to it for years. I'd eaten there many times during the months that I was sober. So I sat down at a table and ordered a sandwich and a glass of milk. Quite sensible. Still no thought of drinking. Underlined it. Still not thinking about a drink. I ordered another sandwich and decided I'd have another glass of milk. Now I highlighted all these italics. I highlighted the whole paragraph that are italics. He said, suddenly, here comes the obsession. Here comes the justification, the peculiar mental twist, the mental blank spot, the illusion, delusion. Suddenly the thought crossed my mind that if I was to put an ounce of whiskey in a glass of ounce of whiskey in my milk, it couldn't hurt me on a full stomach. Because the insanity has blocked out what we told him. It's blocked out the loss of the job and the wife and the threat of asylum. Because the obsession's won over. He's had a sandwich and a glass of milk. He's going to justify that one drink, right? But he said, I vaguely sensed I was not being any too smart. Because he sort of remembered what we told him. But felt reassured that I was taking the whiskey on a full stomach. So his mind flipped. We warned him, Jim, if you drink, you're going to die. You're going to lose this. And then his mind flipped back. Yeah, but it's only going to be one. I've had a glass of milk and a sandwich. This time it's going to be different, the justification. He said the experiment went so well that I ordered another whiskey. Now the allergies kicked in. Now he's getting thirstier. And poured it into the milk. That didn't seem to bother me, so I tried another. Now he's drunk. He had no defense against that first drink. He'd failed to enlarge his spiritual life. Thus started one more journey to the asylum for Jim. He was a threat of commitment, the loss of family and position, to say nothing about that intense and mental and physical suffering that drinking always caused him. And I underlined the next two lines. He had much knowledge about himself as an alcoholic because we told him. Yet for all reasons for not drinking were easily pushed aside in the favour of the, and underlined it, a foolish idea, the obsession, that he could take whiskey if only he mixed it with milk. He justified it. And then we said, we call this, underline this and highlight it, we call it plain insanity. Because we told him about the problem, the damage that would be caused. But the insanity blocked that. It blocked the truth. And that foolish idea, that obsession, that peculiar mental twist, won out. Whatever the precise definition of the word may be, I highlighted this whole paragraph down to have happened. The whole top half of 37 I highlighted. Again, it's a big part of the book. Whatever the precise definition of the word may be, we call it plain insanity. How can such a lack of proportion of the ability to think straight be called anything else with a question mark? You may think this is an extreme case. To us, it's not so far-fetched. Important sentence. This is a really important sentence. For this kind of thinking has been characteristic in every single one of us. Every one of us. Not some. Not the moderate drinker or the hard drinker or the heavy drinker. The chronic, the real, the true alcoholic. In every single one of us. We have sometimes reflected more than Jim did on the consequences, but there was always, and underline this, remember, the curious mental phenomenon. That parallel with our sound reasoning, there inevitably ran some insanely trivial excuse for taking the first drink. Our sound reasoning, our sanity failed to hold us in check. The insane idea won out. Make sense? Our sanity didn't hold us in check. We couldn't see the consequences. That curious mental phenomenon won out. The insanity beat us. And we took a drink, as Jim did. Next day, we would ask ourselves in all earnest and sincerity, how did that happen? How did I get drunk? Because when we're sober and we look back, we go, oh my God, did I do that? Should I have done that? Why didn't I stop? I shouldn't have gone there. But when you're in the moment, and that curious mental phenomenon that justifies that next drink. We don't care about consequences. We're not interested in a nagging wife. Turn my phone off, right? I'm not interested in being late for work tomorrow. In some circumstances, we have gone out deliberately to get drunk, feeling ourselves justified by nervousness. I underlined these five words, actually. Nervousness, anger, worry, depression, or jealousy. I underlined it. And next to that, I wrote attachment to blame. Because I'm going to blame my drinking on that. Well, I was nervous. I was anxious. I was feeling a bit depressed. I was feeling jealous. So I took a drink to make me feel better. Attachment to blame. Or the like. But even in this type of beginning, we are obliged to admit that our justification for a spree was, it, and underline this, was insanely insufficient of the light that always happened. Because I always got drunk. I couldn't drink safely. We now see that when we begin drink deliberately instead of casually, there was little or serious effect. Effective thought during a period of premeditation of what the terrific consequences will be or may be. Our behavior is observed as incomprehensible with respect to the first drink as that of an individual with, say, a passion for, say, jaywalking. Now, we're going to give you an example where we see the insanity in other people, but not in ourselves. He gets a thrill out of jumping and skipping in front of fast-moving vehicles. He enjoys himself for a few years, and in spite of friendly warnings, up to this point, you would label him as a foolish chap. I probably wouldn't, but a foolish chap, right? Having queer ideas are fun. Luck then deserts him, and he is slightly injured several times in succession. You'd expect him, if he were normal, to cut it out. Presently, he's hit again, and this time has a fractured skull. Within a week after leaving the hospital, a fast-moving trolley car breaks his arm. He tells you that he's decided to stop jaywalking for good. But in a few weeks, he breaks both legs. On through the years, this conduct continues. I underlined that. This conduct continues. Accompanied by his continuing promises to be careful to keep off the streets altogether. Finally, he can do no longer work. His wife gets a divorce and is held up to ridicule. He tries every known means of getting the jaywalking idea out of his head. He shuts himself up in an asylum, hoping to mend his ways. But the frightful day comes as he races out in front of a fire engine, which breaks his back. Such a man would be crazy, wouldn't he? Now, I see that. I see how nuts and how insane that. I won't be calling him a foolish chap, let me tell you. I can see it in him. But why can't I see it in my alcoholism? Why can't I see it in the way that I've drunk and the consequences and the problems? Because that insanity in my mind blocks it out. Just like the jaywalker, it's exactly the same. We see it in others, but we don't see it in ourselves. You may think this illustration is too ridiculous, but is it? We who have been through the ringer have to admit, if we substituted alcoholism for jaywalking, the illustration would fit us exactly, and it would, because it's insane, right? However intelligent we may have been in other respects, where alcohol has been involved, we have been strangely insane. It's strong language, but it's true, isn't it? With a question mark. It's true. Some of you are thinking, yes, what you tell us is true, but it doesn't fully apply, because we're going to justify it, right? We admit we have some of these symptoms, but we have not gone to the extremes that you fellows did, nor are we likely to. For we understand so well that what you have told us, that such things cannot happen again. We have not lost a ring in life through drinking, and we certainly didn't intend to. Thanks for the information. And I highlighted from that may be true of certain non-alcoholic people to another illustration. Again, it's another important part. Because that may be true of certain non-alcoholic people. They may be able to stop and moderate, as we spoke on page 20 and 21. They can do that. Thanks for the information. I'm just not going to drink again because it's causing me problems and I won't do it. That may be true of certain non-alcoholic people who, though drinking foolishly and heavily at present time, they are able to stop or moderate. That's them. Because their brains and bodies have not been as damaged as ours first. Now, this is for us. This is a warning. But the actual or potential alcoholic, with hardly any exception, will be absolutely unable to stop drinking on the basis of self-knowledge. We cannot stop on self-knowledge, as Jim just proved us on his story. This is a point we need to emphasize and to re-emphasize to smash home upon our alcoholic readers, as it's been revealed to us out of bitter experience. The condition you got is exactly what we're describing. It will take you to the first drink. On your own power, you cannot stop. Let us take us to another illustration. This is a guy called Harry Brick. His story came in as Fred. He's got a story in one of the books. Fred is a partner in a well-known accounting firm. His income is good. He has a fine home and is happily married and a father of promising children of college age. He is so attractive a personality that he makes friends with everyone. If ever there was a successful businessman, it is Fred. To all appearance, he is a stable, well-balanced individual. Yet he's an alcoholic. We first saw Fred about a year ago in a hospital where he'd gone to recover from a bad case of the jitters. It was his first experience of this kind, and he was much ashamed of it. Far from admitting he was an alcoholic, he told himself he'd come to the hospital, and I underline this, to rest his nerves. It's really a detox, but he didn't like to admit that, right? But Fred was quite a proud guy. The doctor intimated strongly that he might be worse than he realized. For a few days, he was depressed about his condition. He made up his mind to quit drinking altogether. It never occurred to him that perhaps he couldn't do so, in spite of his character and standing. And I highlighted the bottom three lines. Fred will not believe himself an alcoholic. Poor old Fred's in denial, right? We told him about this already, but he wouldn't have it. Man. Much less accept the spiritual remedy for his problem. We told him what we knew about alcoholism, and I highlighted that because we'd done that with Jim on Jim's story, right? But Jim failed to enlarge his spiritual life. Jim got drunk on Succession many times. He was interested and conceded that he had some of the symptoms, but he'd gone a long way from admitting that he could do nothing about it himself. He was positive that his humiliating experience, I'll highlight his next three lines, plus the knowledge he had acquired would keep him sober for the rest of his life. Self-knowledge would fix it. And I highlighted it and I underlined it. Because many believe, now I know what I've got. As Bill Wilson did in his story, self-knowledge would fix it. Now I just won't drink. But we have no defense. We don't enlarge our spiritual life. And we pick a drink and we relapse. Right? We heard no more of Fred for a while. One day we were told that he was back in the hospital. This time he was quite shaky. And he soon indicated he was anxious to see us. Because he knew we had the solution to his problem. The story he told us was most instructive, for he was a chap absolutely convinced he had to stop drinking, who had no excuse for drinking, who exhibited splendid judgment and determination and all his other concerns, yet he was flat on his back nevertheless. Let him tell you about it. This is what Fred said. I was much impressed with what you fellows have said about alcoholism. I frankly did not believe it would be possible for me to drink again. And I highlighted the next sentence. I rather appreciated your ideas about the subtle insanity which precedes the first drink. And next to that, I wrote mind. The obsession, the insanity, right? Step one. But I was confident that it would not happen to me after what I had learned. I reasoned that I was not so far as advanced as most of you fellows. And that I'd been usually successful in licking my other personal problems, and then therefore I will be successful where you men failed. I highlight the next three lines. He said, I felt I had every right to be self-confident because he knows about the condition, but we know it's only a matter of time before it gets him, right? I felt I had a right to be self-confident that it'd be only a matter of exercising my willpower and keeping on my guard. Not that we've all tried that, right? In this frame of mind, I went about my business. For a time, all was well. I had no trouble refusing drinks and began to wonder if I'd not been making too hard work of a simple matter. One day, I went to Washington to present some accounting evidence to a government bureau. I'd been out of town before during this particular dry spell, so there was nothing new about that. It's important. I highlighted these next four or five lines. Physically, I felt fine. Neither did I have any pressing problems or worries. My business came off well. I was pleased and knew my partners would be. It was the end of a perfect day, not a cloud on the horizon. He had no reason to drink. He knew of the condition. He said a perfect day, not a cloud on the horizon. He didn't have a row with the wife and the husband and getting pissed off, right? He then said, I went to my hotel and leisurely dressed for dinner. As I crossed the threshold of the dining room and I highlighted the next two lines, he said, the thought came to mind that it would be nice to have a couple of cocktails with dinner. That was all, nothing more. He justified it. The obsession come in, the insanity blocked out the consequences that we told him about on the page prior. It's only a matter of exercising my willpower, he said. And the thought came in, Fred took two glasses of wine, a couple of cocktails. Nothing more. I ordered a cocktail at my meal, and I ordered another cocktail. Now the allergic reaction's kicked in, the allergy to alcohol. Now he's going to get thirstier. After dinner, I decided to take a walk. When I returned to the hotel, it struck me that a highball, which is a short, will be fine before going to bed. So I stopped and stepped into the bar, and I had one. I remember having several more that night and plenty the next morning. I had a shadowy recollection of being in an airplane bound for New York and of finding a friendly taxi cab driver at the landing field instead of my wife. Why? Because he's phoned her up drunk and she said, "You ain't pissing coming home in that condition." So she said, right? "You ain't coming back like that again. You promised you would never do it again." Got the taxi driver. I know little about where I went, what I said and did. Then came the hospital, and underline this, with the unbearable mental and physical suffering, the DTs. I highlighted the bottom paragraph now. He said, as soon as I regained my ability to think, I went carefully over that evening in Washington. Not only have I been off guard, I'd made no fight whatever against the first drink. And the next day, I wrote powerless. We have no defense against the first drink. We haven't got the power. We are powerless over that first drink. This time, I'd not even thought of the consequences at all. The insanity, right? I'd commenced to drink as carelessly as though cocktails were ginger ale. I now remember what my alcoholic friends had told me and how they prophesied that I have an alcoholic mind, and I underlined this twice over. The time and place would come, I would drink. Because that is the importance of step one. If you don't understand it, the time will come that I would drink again. 42. I said that though I did raise a defense, it would someday give way to some, underline this, trivial reason. Any excuse. He was celebrating. He was pissed off with a wife. He was unhappy. He was depressed. But he was full of fear. We don't need an excuse to take a drink. For having a drink. Well, that did just happen. And more. And I highlighted these next two lines. For what I'd learned of alcoholism did not occur to me at all. We told him step one and two. But because he never enlarged his spiritual life, he got drunk again. I knew from that moment I had an alcoholic mind. I saw that willpower and self-knowledge would not help me, underline this, strange mental blank spots. The obsession. The next day I wrote malady, actually, because mental malady covers the obsession and the insanity. Malady. I'd never been able to understand people who said that a problem had them hopelessly defeated. I knew then, and I underlined this, it was a crushing blow. Because when I come to AA, I didn't want to be an alcoholic. Once I went through the 12 steps and I recovered and things changed, my life got a whole lot better. I'm actually thankful that I'm an alcoholic because I'm a completely different person to what I'd become. Two of the members of Alcoholics Anonymous came to see me. They grinned, which I didn't like so much. Then they asked me if I thought myself alcoholic, and I highlighted these next two lines. And if I was really linked this time, are you done drinking, Fred? I had to concede to broke propositions. He had to concede to his innermost self. He cannot drink safely. Are you done, Fred? There's no half measures. You're either in or you're out, right? They piled on heaps of evidence to the effect that an alcoholic mentality, such as I had exhibited in Washington, underline this, was a hopeless condition. And on the next night, I wrote hopeless, powerless, godless. Hopeless, powerless, godless. They cited cases out of their own experience by the dozen. This process snuffed out the last flicker of conviction that I could do the job myself. We smashed that one into him. He finally knew he had a condition that he couldn't control. He was completely powerless over it. He couldn't control and enjoy it. He had the obsession, the illusion, the delusion, the insanity, the peculiar mental twist, the strange mental blank spots. It all came clear to him. To drink is to die. He couldn't control it. He couldn't enjoy it. We smashed in step one. And Fred finally got it. They then outlined a spiritual answer and the program of action to which 100 of them had followed successfully. And next day I wrote step two. Because now we're going to lay out the spiritual toolkit for Fred to take. Fred got sober, became a great member of AA and sponsored many people. Though I'd only been a nominal churchman, Their proposals were not intellectually hard to swallow. And I highlighted now from here down to the bottom of the page. But the programme of action, though entirely sensible, and was pretty drastic. It meant I would have to throw several lifelong conceptions out of the window because Fred's ideas didn't work, right? That was not easy, but the moment I made up my mind to go through the process, I had a curious feeling that my alcoholic condition was relieved, as in fact it proved to be step-free. Quite as important was the discovery that spiritual principles would solve and underline all my problems. The depression, the fear, the anxiety. I've since been brought into a new way of living, infinitely more satisfying and, I hope, more useful than life I'd ever lived before. My old manner was by no means a bad one, but I would not exchange its best moments for the worst I have now. I would not go back even if I could. Fred's story speaks for itself. We hope it strikes home to thousands like him. It felt only the first nip of the ringer. Most alcoholics have to be pretty badly mangled before they really commence to solve their problems. Many doctors and psychiatrists agree without conclusions. And one of these men, a staff member at a world-renowned hospital, was called a guy called Percy Pollock, recently made this statement to some of us. What you say about the general hopelessness of the average alcoholic's plight is, in my opinion, correct. As two of you men whose stories I have heard, there is no doubt in my mind that you are 100% hopeless. Apart from divine help, had you have offered yourselves as patients in this hospital, I would not have taken you. If you've been able to avoid it, people like you are too heartbreaking. Though not a religious person, I have a profound respect for the spiritual approach in such cases as yours. For most cases, there is virtually no other solution. And I highlighted his last four lines. Because the last time it's going to remind you about step one. It says, once more, the alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defense against that first drink. Except in a few rare cases, neither he nor any other human being can provide such a defense. And I highlighted this and underlined it. His defense must come from a higher power. That's a good move, isn't it? Let me stop recording.